This is KGNU's Morning Magazine for Monday, May 31st. I'm your host, Shannon Young. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, in recognition of Memorial Day, we'll hear from the VA about efforts to address suicides, the leading cause of service member deaths. Environmental activists gathered in Boulder Saturday in support of a statewide climate bill the governor is threatening to veto. Vaccinations against COVID-19 continue across the nation, but unlike last Memorial Day, this year many who have received the vaccination are ditching masks, which have now become a habit for many. We'll have a commentary coming up on unmasking. Finally, Miriam Schiff shares a preview of this afternoon's Metro show airing at 3 p.m. when she interviews author and poet Bruce Sterling on grief and the process of grieving. At the bottom of the hour, we'll hear the BBC headlines, and then it's a public affair. Rosanna Longo looks at the history of the internment of Japanese Americans in the U.S. during World War II. Then comes Counterspin at 9 a.m., a look at fairness and accuracy in reporting. But first, a look at the headlines with KGNU's Jamie Sudler.
The rate of death among Coloradans from all causes jumped last year by nearly 25% in comparison to what would be considered a normal year. An analysis by the Denver Post shows that in 2020, almost 9,000 more residents died in the state than compared to the previous 5 years. An analysis of death certificates shows that coronavirus contributed to more than half of Colorado's excess mortality last year. COVID-19 became the third leading cause of death in the state behind cancer and heart disease. Other causes of death, including chronic liver disease, Alzheimer's, and drug overdoses, also rose. The amounts of deaths for people of color rose much more in the state than among whites. For the Latinx population and Asian American and Pacific Islanders, death rates last year from all causes rose by close to 35%, and over 30% for black Coloradans and just under 20% for Native Americans. In comparison, the overall mortality rate for white non-Hispanic groups rose less than 8%, with a decline in deaths from cancer, heart disease, strokes, and suicides offsetting some of the impact of COVID-19. Fatal drug overdoses in Colorado surged in 2020. Jeff Holliday of the Denver Health Department said the uncertainty and isolation brought on by the pandemic is likely a contributing factor to the rise in overdoses. The Denver Sheriff Department announced that two deputies who contracted the virus have died in less than 2 weeks. One had worked for the sheriff for 25 years and the other for 7. The Colorado Sun reports that, like other workplaces, the Sheriff's Department does not require its employees to be vaccinated, although it has tried to educate employees about vaccinations. As of yesterday, just over 470 people are hospitalized in the state with COVID-19, and Colorado's 7-day positivity rate decreased to 2.85%. Denver School Board member and activist Tay Anderson will step away from his duties while an independent investigation is conducted into allegations he committed sexual misconduct, according to the announcement from the board. Anderson was already under investigation by the school district for a single sexual assault allegation since early April. The Denver Post reports that last week a parent of a DPS student told a legislative committee that more than 60 people had come to her for help regarding a single individual, but she did not name that person. She described their experiences ranged from unwanted touching to violent acts of rape. She said 61 of them lacked documentation or were recipients of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, and the youngest was 14. Denver Public Schools said that its board and the Denver Police Department are aware of new sexual assault allegations against Anderson after the woman testified about a sexual predator within the school system who was targeting students. In a statement Friday night, the board said that it was later informed that the accusations were against Anderson and that the police are aware of them. Yesterday, Anderson described on Twitter that the allegations are false and have caused a great deal of trauma to the entire district and have put his family and him in harm's way. The man who is expected to be confirmed as the new superintendent of Denver Public Schools has been sued for conduct at his prior job in New York State. Alex Marrero was the interim superintendent at the New Rochelle school system for less than a year. Dr. Brooke Balkin, the former medical director of that district, has filed a case against him and other members of that district saying that she was sidelined, silenced, and retaliated against in connection with the district's response to the COVID-19 pandemic. The president and vice president of the Denver board said in a statement that they have full confidence in Dr. Marrero and that they stand behind their choice of him for superintendent. Marrero's appointment is set to be approved by the Denver Board of Education on Thursday. Governor Jared Polis on Friday signed a law that allows cities and counties to require affordable housing in new rental developments. The Colorado Sun reports the law effectively reverses a 20-year-old court precedent that has blocked jurisdictions from forcing developers to build affordable housing. The law comes as communities from Front Range cities to mountain towns are facing an unprecedented housing crisis, with largely low and moderate income workers being priced out of housing. At the bill's signing ceremony, the governor said that communities are strongest when people work in them and can live in them, which is sadly something the state has been losing. An activist who wants to run for a seat on the Aurora City Council has sued that city because of a charter provision precluding her from seeking office due to a decades-old felony conviction. Candace Bailey, represented by the ACLU, claims that barring felons from running for office violates the state constitution and that people who complete their criminal sentences regain their full rights, including the ability to run for public office. The Aurora Sentinel reports that Bailey declared her intent to run for an at-large council seat in February. She was convicted in 1999 of second-degree assault and sentenced to 2 years in prison. In a statement, Bailey said that mistakes of your life shouldn't stop you from living life to the fullest or being of service, adding it's not about her alone, but about making sure that all future candidates with felony convictions won't face the same barrier she has, and ultimately for voters to decide who they want to represent their communities. Rainy weather will continue this Memorial Day and into the night, with the high today about 62. Tomorrow will be warmer with highs in the low 70s and a chance of showers afternoon. Mostly sunny skies return Wednesday. Right now it's about 48 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
You are listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. Environmental activists gathered in Boulder Saturday in support of a statewide climate bill, SB 200. Governor Jared Polis has stated he intends to veto the bill if it passes. The bill puts caps on greenhouse gas emissions and would give more teeth to air quality enforcement mechanisms. KGNU's Rosana Longo brings us these voices from Saturday's march.
My name is Jeeva Senthilnathan. I'm currently 19 years old. I'm here in Boulder, Colorado today in support to reduce greenhouse gases and to make sure that SB 200 doesn't get vetoed from Governor Polis' office. SB 200 stands for Senate Bill 200. It is a state bill that is focusing on climate. It is sponsored by Senator Faith Winters and Representative Dominique Jackson and also Senator Dominic Moreno. SB 200 is a bill that is in support of preserving Colorado's air and to make sure that it is clean air and we get clean water. And it's important that we get clean energy within the state of Colorado. I'm in general support of the climate here.
As I was walking here, somebody said to me the SB 200 is really about stopping fracking in Colorado. Would you agree with that?
I absolutely do agree.
How is it that SB can stop fracking in this state where we have so much fracking already?
There's just like a lot of, you know, projects and pipelines going into place right now. And I know that SB 200 can definitely stop a lot of those projects and it can help protect a lot of people living in different areas, especially like those living in the Fort Collins area where there was a pipeline planned. And so in general, I just think that it's important to have clean energy and protecting air quality within the state of Colorado, and SB 200 does exactly that.
We're here with 350. My name is Emma, and we're here because climate change is at the last preventable point, and we really need to listen to scientists, and that's why we're here to support SB 200, which makes that enforceable. It's a bill that would basically help Colorado stick to the climate change goals that we need to be following to prevent further changes and to protect our planet in the future.
The march was organized here in Boulder because this is the hometown from Governor Jared Polis. You're making a statement by being here.
That's correct. Governor Polis is threatening to veto this bill, even though he ran on the promise that he would protect the climate and that he would be a climate champion. So we're here to just let him know that we're watching him and that we know that he is, you know, he has a lot of power in this situation, and he's the one who can make this happen or make it not happen. So we're here to really just put the pressure on him.
My name is Keegan Jack. I'm also here with Sunrise, and I do think that this bill is super important, and I'm seeing that Jared Polis is hesitant to actually hold companies accountable. He believes that by creating a system for fining these companies, these polluters, that he's actually taking too much power, when really the polluters are the ones with the power, and we need to take that power back. It's essential that we actually hold them accountable, and I think he's afraid to do that. He's afraid to take on his promises, because his promises are not really promises. They're just words, and we need to hold them accountable to those words.
Yes, my name is Ian, E-A-N, Tafoya, T-A-F-O-Y-A, and we're here today to say that Frontlines are united with other individuals in fighting back against fossil fuels, against corporate strength that has driven laws that have not served those most in need. And we're here demanding that our leaders make a choice. People are polluters today.
I see you're wearing a t-shirt, Green Latinos, Latino Environmental and Conservation Advocates. I also see and heard that you call on this land from who it really belonged to. So if you can speak about that.
Yes, well, my ancestors are Jicarilla Apache and Oke Owingue from the headwaters of the Rio Grande. For the last 500 years, broken promises have led us to where we are today. And the same concerns we have about elected leaders breaking promises are ones that are shared by Indigenous people. And we believe we have the answers that have stewarded this land for a very long time. And we just want to be listened to.
Homes are on fire. In a world,
why do you think Polis is not willing to sign SB 200 when he promised that he will support and help promote a better climate?
That's the $1 million question. He's busy giving millions of dollars away for vaccines. We hope he can put the same amount of effort into the climate action.
For KGNU, I am Rosana Longo.
This time last year, we were all getting used to wearing face coverings due to COVID. A year later, we're taking them off. Priscilla Dan Courtney is a clinical psychologist and writer in Boulder and has a regular opinion column in the Boulder Daily Camera. Today, she shares her recent commentary with KGNU called Unmasking Our World.
When I heard the news, you may now remove your mask, I felt teary. The mandate stipulates that those who are fully vaccinated can forgo masks in most indoor and outdoor settings. However, the guidelines encourage those who are not vaccinated to continue with face coverings. My tears as a vaccinated individual were complicated. They were tears that held relief and joy, yet also apprehension. As when we played the childhood game, Pin the Tail on the Donkey, and we were told we could remove the blindfold, we saw how disoriented we had been, often pinning a tail on a doorway or lampshade. Although we've had our eyes open and mouth and nose covered, there is no denying this has been a very disorienting year. What felt like overnight, we were forced into confinement to protect ourselves and others from a serious and often deadly virus. It was a difficult transition for most of us. Masks could raise issues in which individuals felt burdened, claustrophobic, alienated from others, and even in some cases frightened or traumatized by the masked world. But with time, most of us oriented ourselves to a new, restrictive lifestyle with clear guidelines. Senses that often brought a sense of safety and security, even if in reality our full protection wasn't feasible. We slowly became oriented to a changed world and no longer felt we were blindly pinning tails on lampshades. Early on, I often would forget my mask. Now I forget to take it off. Surprisingly, my flowered mask became a soft security blanket, like my son's fuzzy of childhood. I am grateful for our recovering world, yet sobered by an awareness that the United States is more privileged than most nations. The freedom to remove our masks marks a historical moment, opening up choices and change for our future, allowing for a deep breath of fresh air, literally and figuratively. Yet change can be difficult. We may feel the joy of freedom, but simultaneously disoriented and anxious, as we did in March 2020. We are faced with possibly reconfiguring our work environment along with where, when, and frequency of social interaction. Many who have worked from home will now consider returning to the office or instigating a hybrid model. Socially, there may be the pleasure of returning to be with friends in person, but also wanting to preserve the solitude and less busyness that the pandemic allowed. With our return, we are now designers of sorts, hopefully with a chance for home improvement. The last year has unfortunately led to so much loss for many, and the return may hold sorrow emotionally, physically, and financially, since things are not how they were. Thus, removing our mask will likely unmask a multitude of feelings, which must be embraced with kindness and compassion. Given how much has been out of our control over the last year, when possible, a gradual return with a sense of agency and mindfulness will enhance the transition back to a fast-paced world that will place more expectations upon us. Given the ongoing polarity we experience on so many issues, mask wearing will be no different. There are no longer directives in many situations, thus taking personal responsibility for our health and those of others will be our guide. Coming from a place of awareness and acceptance of our feelings about returning fosters our ability to find compassion for the choices of others. An open heart toward ourselves encourages empathy all around. Everyone has their own reasons, history, and situational factors that ask for understanding versus judgment. The virus is the enemy, not our neighbors with differences. As many of us pull down our masks, the smile will hopefully take more of center stage. Actually, the smile is the most universal and recognized facial expression. We have been robbed of that beautiful gesture while in public for many months. It has the power to bring a sense of internal peace, as well as providing others with a sense of well-being. We do have to continue to hold both the joy and sorrow in an ever-changing world, yet we have finally been granted a tender gift. The smile has been unmasked. This is Priscilla Dan Courtney.
Now, KGNU's Hannah Lee Myers speaks to the director of the Veterans Administration's Rocky Mountain Suicide Prevention Center to bring us this report on why preventing service member suicide warrants focus on Memorial Day.
Service members who lose their lives in combat are often on the forefront of the public's minds on Memorial Day. However, in reality, more veterans lose their lives from suicide related to their service than on deployment. Late last year, the Department of Veterans Affairs released a 2020 National Veteran Suicide Prevention Report, looking at extensive data gathered 2 years prior. According to the report, around 6,400 veterans died by suicide in 2018 alone. By contrast, between 2001 and 2018, 7,000 enlisted troops have died in conflict zones. Advocates for veterans are using Memorial Day as an opportunity to both remember service members who lose their lives battling mental health challenges and to educate the public on how to help prevent suicide deaths. One such advocate is Dr. Lisa Brenner, a research clinical psychologist and director of the Rocky Mountain Mental Illness Research Education and Clinical Center, or MIREC, at the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Memorial Day is a very meaningful day to me and all of us who work here at the Rocky Mountain MIREC and at the VA, because we're certainly thinking about kind of some of the successes we've had, but also challenges and this ongoing challenge around suicide. The challenge around suicide is not only a veterans challenge, but it's a national challenge. Suicide rates are up, not this past year, but in general, suicide rates have been up across the country and all demographic groups. And the Rocky Mountain region really is a high-risk region. If you look at data from Colorado, from Utah, from Montana, we are really very high when compared to other states.
According to that 2020 National Veteran Suicide Prevention Report, In 2018 in Colorado, the veteran suicide rate had reached record numbers and was significantly higher than the national average, with more than one veteran dying by suicide each week. I asked Dr. Brenner what the Rocky Mountain MIREC is doing to help prevent suicide deaths and what resources they've made available to veterans as well as their friends and families.
We're really engaged here in a number of different activities, both, you know, at the patient level, at the provider level, at the community level, and then working with folks across the country to really make a difference at all levels. And one thing I really want to highlight for folks today is, you know, this is like everybody's business. Everybody can be engaged. Everybody can be learning how to kind of recognize when folks are having challenges, can know more about what resources are available to individuals, whether that's the Veterans Crisis Line or local crisis lines or local crisis resources. And I always like to say to folks, you know, you never want to plan for a crisis during a crisis. So if folks could take a little time ahead of the crisis or ahead of kind of knowing that folks in the community might be struggling and know how to help individuals or how to recognize things, that would be a great Memorial Day activity, I think. In terms of the work that we're doing, we do research, as our center would suggest, and really trying to identify new best practices, but also really trying to figure out how to help care providers, healthcare communities, and communities on whole engage in best practices. And one thing we've been really involved with across the VA is universal screening for suicide risk. VA has now engaged in the largest ever U.S. effort to screen everybody for suicide risk. And this screening is happening in lots of different settings. So my dad's a vet. He gets care at the VA. And, you know, he always tells me when he goes to the cardiologist or somewhere that maybe he doesn't expect to be asked, and he's asked. And I'm like, yeah, that's great. Because we really need, you know, even folks who maybe don't see this as being their job to really be asking. And there are a number of folks who won't kind of talk about suicide and their own risk unless we ask them. One of the other things I do want to highlight that we do is we have a national consult service, and this national consult service is for providers. It's for providers that are in VA, but it's also for providers outside of VA and outside of VA working with veterans. So this national consult service is available to talk about specific cases or to talk about how to better set up services within your center to meet the needs of veterans and others regarding best practices for suicide prevention. The other thing that I want to highlight is the idea of postvention. Memorial Day, we often spend time thinking about people that we've lost and people that we've lost to suicide. And we don't sometimes think about postvention, which is kind of how do you process the loss? How do you really work through the loss as an individual, as a community? And that's a super important part of suicide prevention. And we have lots and lots of resources on our website, videos, tools, information about postvention, and really making sure that folks who have lost individuals to suicide are doing the work that they need to do to take care of themselves and the people around them to prevent future suicide.
So Dr. Brenner, I wanted to ask you how you would suggest addressing the fact that sometimes it's hard to know that an individual, and particularly a veteran, might be struggling with mental health issues, that they might feel depressed, and they might be even contemplating suicide. What tips do you have on how to make sure that those individuals are receiving the support that they need from their friends and family?
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing I think that can be really helpful is finding words and having words ready to kind of be prepared to ask. If we don't ask, they're not going to talk about it. And by showing somebody that you're willing to ask and that you're prepared to ask and that you're willing to kind of sit through a hard conversation about it, that already tells people that you can handle it, that you don't have stigma about it yourself necessarily, and that you're open to the conversation. So there's lots of resources on the internet and other places about kind of how do you just ask people? How do you ask the question? One other resource that's available to individuals, it's called SAVE, and it's VA Suicide Prevention Gatekeeper Training. If individuals search SAVE VA Gatekeeper, they can find it online. And this is a free resource to individuals, anybody. And what it really does is it allows opportunities to practice and find the right words. And it also gives a lot of information about myths and disinformation, specific risk factors and warning signs for suicide. And really, you know, as SAVE would be, it's like signs of suicide, asking about suicide, validating feelings, encouraging help, and expediting treatment. And that's what SAVE stands for. And this idea that you have this prepared ahead of time. You know how to encourage help. You know how to expedite treatment. You've got the right words already. You're not trying to make up the words as you go in the crisis. And that this is available online for free. And we really encourage folks to do this kind of work ahead of time. It doesn't take very long. There's shorter versions, longer versions, but doing this resource searching ahead of time for the right words and the right ways to help people find help can save lives.
You can find links to all the resources listed in this story and more at news.kgnu.org. Wishing listeners a safe and healthy Memorial Day. For KGNU, I'm Hanalee Myers.
On today's Metro Show at 3 p.m., host Miriam Schiff interviews poet Bruce Sterling, author of the book Not Enough, Musing on Grief. Here's a preview of that upcoming conversation.
What happened on the evening of your 56th birthday and the seven words that changed your life?
I was home and there was a knock at the door. I was getting ready to go out and celebrate my birthday. I opened the door and the police were there. And they asked to come in, which I abided. And as the second officer crossed my path, he said, "There's no easy way to say this." And at that point, images flashed through my mind. Questions, thoughts. It was one of the most surreal experiences of my life.
What did he share with you? What was the hardest words to say for him?
Well, he just straight out said that my parents had died in an automobile accident.
Tune in to learn more at 3 p.m. today on KGNU's Metro Show with Miriam Schiff. Thanks for tuning in to the Morning Magazine today on KGNU. I've been your host, Shannon Young.